Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
At 11:10 a.m., on Tuesday the 20th of March 1968, three inexperienced robbers forced their way into flat 35. A stylish apartment owned by wealthy stockbroker Michael O'Carroll and his pregnant wife, Janet. As an ill-conceived heist by an out-of-work dance teacher, swimming instructor, and a trainee football coach, with the robbery having backfired, they had no plan B. Expecting a payout of £20,000 to £30,000, £250,000 today, they had made just £220, of which they had to refund £10 to their increasingly knocked fence. The stockbroker was broke. His bank account was deeply in debt. His wife's Mini was unsellable. And all that was left was a 4-year-old Lancia. Split in their minuscule haul, Dave paid off his rent. Mike stayed in a hotel. And Ray got the brakes of his dodgy car fixed. But now they risked lengthy prison sentences for robbery, fraud, and kidnapping. These were not hardened criminals with a master plan. They were three incompetents without a clue what to do. They'd been seen by the porters.
What flat do you want? Flat 35. O'Carroll.
They had earned almost nothing. They had touched almost everything. They were stuck with two hostages who knew their names. And having barely slept a wink in almost 36 hours, nothing made any sense. At 2:45 p.m., Dave Bolton got Michael O'Carroll to call his work, stating,
"I won't be back today. Jan's not feeling great."
Therefore, no one would know that this couple were being held a hostage for at least a day. Leaving Mike Ellis and Dave, the man with the plan, to work out what to do next. Ray Cohen left at 4 p.m. He got the Lancia. He met a girlfriend on King's Road. He watched Chelsea beat Sheffield Wednesday. And at 10 p.m.
Dave suggested that Mike and I take the car to Glasgow.
And as Ray and Mike drove 390 miles to sell a stolen car in Scotland, these inept hoods left behind a trail of evidence and a horrific double murder. The almost new Lancia roared up the dark-lit motorway. With Ray driving, Mike napping, and these two buddies for barely a few months, swapping over between loo breaks and hot snacks in roadside cafes. Ray struggled a bit with the gears of this Italian sports car, as when he slipped from third to fourth, they crunched. But then again, this sleek, shiny chick magnet was far superior to his rusty old death trap. This was a 1964 Lancia Flavia two-door convertible, able to do 0 to 60 in 10.8 seconds, with a top speed of 125 miles an hour. It was purchased new 4 years before for £1,900, £40,000 today. Being in mint condition with leather seats, they knew they could flog off this second-hand motor for a third of its price. Maybe £600, making them £200 apiece. Which wasn't great, but then it wasn't terrible, and neither was it nothing. And unlike Janet's Mini, they knew they wouldn't have a problem selling it, as having the car's logbook, the proof of ownership, and Michael's driving license, either man could pass as its owner. In the early hours of Wednesday the 13th of March, Ray and Mike arrived in Glasgow. As before, their mission would be simple. But from the start, their inexperience and immaturity would shine through. Ray would state,
"We arrived and booked in at the Station Hotel, facing Old Buchanan Street Station. For reasons I don't know, Mike told me to book in as Mr. O'Carroll."
The pettiness of these squabbling felons is hard to fathom, as without a grown adult to smack the back of their legs and growl, "No," when they played up, they acted like two puppies who'd sprung the back garden gate and were excitably running loose on a busy road, shitting everywhere and blaming the others. Upon arrival, having checked in under the names of Cohen and Ellis, their real names, although they were technically on the run, Ray and Mike treated themselves to a swanky haircut and a close shave at the hotel barber's. And as they sat back, neither man would realise until later that they had dropped a large envelope containing the Lancia's logbook, on the front of which they had written the name O'Carroll. At 11:30 a.m, Ray took the Lancia to W. Fraser, a car dealership.
"Mr. Fraser said he was interested in buying the car, and I left him with the particulars."
Which led to another stumbling block. They didn't know whether Michael O'Carroll actually owned the car, or if he was paying it off in installments. So over the next few hours, Ray proceeded to call the dealership on an hourly basis as they performed a HP check. As you do when you're on the run, Ray and Mike were as low-key and discreet as a drag queen drunkenly humping a Christmas tree. Via the hotel switchboard, they made numerous calls to London, with Ray even calling his mummy to tell her that he was okay. And at 6 p.m, as if this wasn't suspicious enough, they checked out of the rather modest Station Hotel and moved into the more exclusive Central Hotel, because
it would look better to potential car buyers if we were in a classier place.
Yeah, right. Having moved hotels, leaving a wealth of fingerprints which would later be identified by the police, while the car dealer checked the legal status of the Lancia, Ray and Mike went on a little spending spree. Ray later accused Mike of splashing out.
He bought a new suitcase, socks, shirts, ties, shoes, and even a three-piece suit.
And although it incensed him, he would later admit,
"We had a few drinks at the bar. We went out to the cinema. And after that, we went gambling at a casino called Chevalier. Mike lost 20 quid, and I won 50.
Of course, when you're confessing your crime to the police, it's always good to brag about your blackjack skills. But conveniently for his alibi, his winnings that night exactly matched the money he had made by fencing the stolen loot. On Thursday the 14th of March, Ray and Mike went to Fraser's and were thrilled to learn that the car had passed the HP check. Only,
he offered 520 quid, but we wanted over 600.
Hit in a greedy impasse, having rejected his offer, they took the Lancia to another Glasgow-based car dealer, Ian Farr. But he would piss on their plans when he dropped the bombshell.
"I'm not buying this. It's a dog. The gearbox is shite."
And again, just like the Mini, they couldn't sell the Lancia. This nearly new but badly broken sports car was now a dead weight around their necks, and it was drawing attention. Ray and Mike were 390 miles from home, and of the £70 they had each made from the robbery, most of it they'd already spent. And now, it was about to get worse. With the stolen car proven to be a bit of a hot potato in Glasgow,
Mike said he would take the car to Ireland. He asked, would I come? And I said, yeah, might as well.
They had no contacts in the Irish city of Dublin, but having seen it in a hotel pamphlet, they thought it looked nice. So they drove 86 miles southwest to the port town of Stranraer. But it was then, while sat inside of this unsellable Lancia, that Mike would drop another bombshell.
On arriving at Stranraer, Mike told me there was something I should know.
His face was pale and his eyes were wide.
He went to the boot of the car and showed me a newspaper.
It was a copy of that day's Scottish Daily Express. In it was a lengthy piece featuring a photo of Mr. and Mrs. O'Carroll, alongside several words he expected, like Bayswater, Falmouth House, hostage and robbery. But one word he did not. Murder. The bodies of Mr. and Mrs. O'Carroll had been found by the police in flat 35, having been tied up, gagged, stabbed, and strangled. Fingerprints had been found, and three men had been seen entering the flats. For Ray, he began to shake as he read further, knowing his life as a free man was over. Only one further fact shook him to his very core.
I knew immediately that I was mixed up with two murderers.
Having admitted it was he who had murdered Janet Williams, Ray was now sat in the victim's car alongside one of these slayers. And of their crimes, he was an accomplice.
I was very shocked for quite a while, not knowing what to do. I decided, in my own mind, that I was going to somehow get back to London. I had to make sure that Mike didn't know this. And as he was very hungry, we found a Chinese restaurant on the seafront and I tried to eat as calmly as possible.
Trying hard not to tremble, as he shoveled chopped suey with his chopsticks. Although Ray was sat just inches from Mike, it was clear that he was no more a cold-blooded killer than he was a criminal mastermind. In his own words,
"She'd seen everything. I had to strangle her."
That night, as they went aboard the ferry at Stranraer,
"We noticed that we were getting strange looks, so we drove out of town."
Seizing the opportunity, Ray didn't flee.
"I asked him to take me to Prestwick Airport. I was surprised he had not minded doing this, knowing full well that I intended to return to London."
Catching the last flight out of Prestwick, Mike and Ray parted ways. Ray dumped the Lancia in the airport car park, as it had been reported missing in the papers, and he caught a coach to Margate, where he laid low for the next week. Ray's return to London had left him with a deadly conundrum. Protect his cohorts by admitting only his part in the robbery, but denying any knowledge of them or their actions. Or give them up, saving himself from possibly being charged with a double murder, only to risk the two killers hunting him down and harming him or his family for breaking his silence. When he was asked why he hadn't come straight to the police, Ray would state,
"I needed time to sort myself out, and I was worried about Dave finding me."
Typically for such a tragic tale of incompetence, Ray actually went to Scotland Yard to hand himself in. But as the desk sergeant didn't know which station was handling the case, Ray simply walked out. But fearing for his life, Ray handed his old pal, Couras, a slip of paper.
"I wrote down the names, Dave Bolton and Michael Ellis, the two men involved in the murder, on one of his cards, and I gave it to him on the understanding that if anything happened to me, he would disclose the names to the police."
On the morning of Saturday the 16th of March, Ray handed himself in at Paddington Police Station. Having been cautioned, almost everything you have heard so far has come from his confession. Barely an hour after it was dumped, a patrolling policeman found Michael O'Carroll's easily identifiable Lancia at Abbots Inch Airport in Glasgow, containing more than 30 fingerprints of Ray Cohen and Mike Ellis. Of course, they could have torched the car, erasing any trace of themselves. But they didn't. That same day, a postman spotted a rucksack dumped outside of the John Knox Church at 34 Carton Place in Glasgow, containing documents in the name of O'Carroll and Mike Ellis's bloodstained suit. Of course, they could have dumped the bag in the Clyde River, barely 10 feet away, but they didn't. At roughly 6 p.m, on Wednesday the 13th of March, a phone rang again inside flat 35. Only no one answered. Missing business calls and personal appointments, concerned colleagues and relatives had asked the porters, Albert Bryant and Joseph Buckley, to knock on the door. But outside the flat, it was eerily silent. Left uncollected, at the foot of the door lay a newspaper, a bottle of milk, and a dozen eggs. With the heating left on, like many other flats, the hallway was reassuringly warm, as if the occupants were still in. It was as they'd expected. Shoes by the door, a hat on a stand, the Persian rug unruffled, and soft lights emanating from the lounge and both bedrooms at the end of the hall. But something was not right. As with no television, no radio, and no chatter, the flat was devoid of life. As the porters traversed this long, thin hallway, the only hint of disarray they saw was a broken mirror. Ahead lay the lounge. Entering this wide-open room, they saw a scene not too dissimilar to those they had witnessed many times before in their careers as porters at Falmouth House. A stylish room, dotted with seemingly the remnants of a party. Several half-empty bottles of spirits, a few discarded glasses, unwashed dinner plates with the remnants of eggs, rye vita, and corn on the cob, and the ashtray full. With the record player on, but the music long since finished, it wasn't wrong to assume that a party had taken place. As being a popular couple, they'd hosted a little drink soiree barely 1 week before. But as with all parties, not every detail made sense. As on the coffee table, a wallet had been splayed open. And on the sofa, a pair of nylon tights had been tied with hard knots and cut with something sharp. Whatever had happened, the partygoers were long gone, and all that remained was a ghost of a memory. As outside of the partially open French windows, life carried on. Having followed the light to the bathroom, Joseph entered. But the pristine white room was empty and clean, with no signs of sickness or disturbance, and no sighting of its owners. But it was then that, outside of the bathroom door, Albert spotted on the parquet floor a 6-inch kitchen knife. A stainless steel blade of the highest quality, glinting bright, but with just its tip caked in a dark red goo. With the soft light spewing from two remaining rooms, Albert and Joseph entered the opposing doors. They didn't need to enter further to understand what had happened. The silence of their lips and the wideness of their eyes told each other what was within. It was a sight unlike anything they would ever wish to see again, and something they could never unsee. the investigation was headed up by Detective Chief Inspector John Bailey. With no signs of forced entry, the police initially thought the occupants had invited their killers back with them. But with Michael in a business suit and Janet dressed to stay in, this didn't seem right. With the drawers ransacked, documents laid out, and personal effects clearly missing, for inexplicable reasons, these three robbers had waited inside the flat with their hostages. Unusually, there were no signs of assault in the lounge. In fact, treating them with kindness, their captors had provided drinks, meals, and entertainment, even given the pregnant woman extra cushions and trips to the bathroom. The relationship between the captors and the hostages was initially cordial. But something had happened. There were no witnesses to this brutal double murder, except for the killers themselves. As Ray had left to find the Lancia, and although the neighbours had heard loud noises, no one bothered to check. By 5 p.m, 6 hours into this hastily concocted heist by halfwits, tension had begun to rise. As Dave realised that the massive payout was now little more than a pitiful £210 and an unsellable car. According to Ray,
Mike said it happened when Mr. O'Carroll dashed for the service bell in the flat
to alert the porters.
Dave put his hand round his neck and he just collapsed. I then asked him what happened to the girl, and he said that she'd seen everything and that he had strangled her.
Later, Mike would deny killing her, and yet her blood would be found on the suit he had dumped in Glasgow. Most likely, being desperate for money, Dave had resorted to torture. With the newlyweds separated and moved to different bedrooms. On the beds, both Janet and Michael were hogtied and gagged with ties and tights. Unable to move and seeing nothing but the pillows below their faces, through the opposing doors of the hall, they could only hear each other's cries, being slightly muffled by the soft music. Playing his wife's pain off against her husband's agony, the more Michael professed that he had nothing else to give, the more they hurt her to hurt him. From barely 20 feet away, he would have heard her cries and her screams. But he could do nothing. Unable to comprehend that he had risked everything for such a pitiful sum of money, Dave grabbed a sharp carving knife from the kitchen. And with Janet face down on the bed, he pressed the blade into the crook of her neck between her jaw and her left ear, piercing her soft flesh to make her squeal. The tip entered the muscle just 1 inch deep. But as the blood poured down her neck, across her face, and pulled about her nose and mouth. Michael could hear her muffled screams. The woman he loved was terrified, choking, and in agonizing pain. And yet still, he could do nothing. Fearing that as a shrewd negotiator, this veteran stockbroker would never give up, Dave turned his torture on Michael so that Janet could hear him hurt. She had always been a nice lady, kind and decent. So maybe, if she heard his screams, the lady with the baby in her belly would find a reason to live. No longer serving a purpose, both Michael and Janet were strangled to death with the scarf. But being left face down on both beds and unable to move, they suffocated in a pool of their own blood. With their fingerprints on file, a trail of evidence leading to their doors, and Ray's confession given at Paddington Police Station, Dave Bolton was arrested at his flat in South Tottenham. And although he denied knowing Mr. and Mrs. O'Carroll or his part in the robbery or murder, as if to mirror the incompetence of this whole robbery, Dave's own wife had brought the suit into court for him to wear, and yet it still had traces on it of his victim's blood. 1 week later, Mike Ellis was arrested, having spent a week at the Butlins holiday camp in Margate. Having turned on each other, the police got statements from Ray and Mike. But with Dave acting like the big I am and described as cocky throughout, all three were formally charged with murder. Tried at the Old Bailey, it was unsurprising that such an inept gang would plead not guilty given the wealth of evidence against them. With the trial split into two, Ray admitted to robbery, and with his alibi being that he was at a football match during the time of the murder, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Owing to the evidence presented by Raymond Cohen, on the 22nd of July 1968, David Bolton and Michael Ellis were found guilty of all charges. Dave Bolton was sentenced to 15 years for robbery, Mike Ellis to 12 years having pleaded guilty, and both were given life sentences for murder to run concurrently. The robbery of Flat 35 should have been a simple home invasion, but being a half-baked heist by a band of incompetents with a hastily concocted plan to solve an easily rectifiable problem, being so inept and ill-equipped for such a petty crime, their idiocy had led to a brutal double murder. And yet, even before they had entered the flat, all three men were in too deep.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's hope that recorded right. Oh, I'm going to take your little hat off. There you go, your little hat's come off. Hope that feels better. Oh, dear. Well, there you go, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. If you can enjoy something like that, it's a bit grim, wasn't it? But something different, an interesting episode, I thought. Interesting two-parter. Didn't feel like it was going to be a three-parter, hence I kept it as a two-parter. But there's loads and loads of stuff. So welcome to Extra Mile, unscripted, unedited bit, blah, blah, blah. Let me go pop on my tea now. Open the window so we can all hear the coot outside mouthing off. He's been outside getting a bit mouthy. My little robin that I've kind of adopted is currently on the bough. I've relocated his nest so I can move on, which is good. There weren't any eggs in there, so that's all fine. But when I have the door shut, he sits outside the door, goes, "Where's my dinner? Where's my dinner?" Because he knows I give him treats because I'm a sap. So I think by the time you get this, it will be almost Christmas. I think this goes out the week building up to Christmas Day. For me, this is nowhere near Christmas. This is near the end of November. I think it's 23rd of November, 24th, something like that. I powered through, got all my work done. No time off, slogging my guts out. So I'm almost done. So, looking forward to getting all this done, finish editing this episode, and then I can go and treat myself to some beers and a nice curry treat. Oh, there's a nice curry place around the corner that does really good food. I treated myself last year and it was really nice, so I'm going to do that this year. Brilliant. That'll probably happen Monday night is curry night, so I should be edited by then, so that's all good and done. What else is going on? This episode almost didn't happen, courtesy of Windows. This is being recorded on backup laptop, because proper laptop. Well, this is now proper laptop. Proper laptop suffered the blue screen of death, blue effing screen of death. Bloody bastards! Luckily, I was halfway through writing the episode, and then I did my usual thing now, which is a backup to Google Drive, even though Google Drive is the problem. I think that's what's going on, is what's calling all these problems is effing Google Drive. Lost that laptop, but I'm using the backup one, so hopefully backup one is recorded nicely and I can get this edited and then we can I can be done. Hooray! Going into the archive soon. Got some new files to look at. Loads I've already done already, but loads that are planning for the year ahead. Hoping to start with a nice, interesting four-parter, I think, which is one I've been planning to do for ages. What else is going on? I was given a complimentary ticket to go and see Glass Onion. We're not meant to say sequel to Knives Out, but it is the sequel to Knives Out. Courtesy of a freebie of Netflix. I was meant to go there the other night to go and watch that. That would have been great fun. Unfortunately, I turned up at 7 o'clock as planned to pick up my tickets, and they'd move me to 9 o'clock. They hadn't told me. They're just like, "Oh, it's sold out." So they moved me to 9 o'clock. The problem is, because I live miles away, I can't make it home. So I haven't watched the film yet. By the time you've watched, you listen to this, I probably have. But yeah, dragged my ass all the way in, organised my day around this, got there, they'd moved my ticket to 9 o'clock, and I went through all my phone. I just went, I can't make it home. It was really annoying, especially as it's a 2-hour film, so it's almost a 3-hour presentation. So, annoying. Tea still brewing. I'm going to get my hot chocolate in a bit. Hot chocolate. I've got some lemon drizzle cake. It's nice from the little bakery up the road. Very nice. It's a nice light lemon drizzle cake. Do you know when sometimes you eat sponge and it can be a bit heavy? They've done it really. It almost feels like a diet cake. In fact, maybe it is. Not that I'm losing weight. I'm not. So big thank you to some patron supporters. So thank you to Steffi Glazer, Philip M. It's M, but Philip M. Dulcie Lane and Crazy Susie. So thank you, Steffi. Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Dulcie. And thank you, Crazy. Although I'm guessing your first name is probably Susie. That's still brewing. So let's do some quiz questions. Don't forget, I haven't edited this episode yet, so I might balls it up, and then we'll do some extra details in a bit. So get ready. Question number one. How much was the Lancia brand new? So basically, how much did Michael pay for the Lancia when he bought it? Question number two. What was the first hotel Ray and Mike checked into in Glasgow? Yeah, pal. Question number three. What names did they check in under? Question number four. What was the name of the casino they went to in Glasgow? Question number five. Why did Ian Farr, the Glasgow-based car dealer, not buy the Lancia? Question number six. Which Irish port were they sailing to? Question number seven, what type of meal did Ray and Mike have in Stranraer? Question number eight, which airport did Ray fly from? That's when he was going from Scotland back to London. Which airport did he fly from? Question number nine, what was the film that Ray said he saw in the ABC Fulham Road Cinema? And question number 10, which police station did Ray initially try to hand himself into? There you go. Don't forget, I haven't edited these episodes yet, and I might balls them up. I deliberately put these questions in and around the same area of my notes because I'm going to use some different notes. So therefore, hopefully, I won't balls up these questions. Let's grab me tea. Wahey! Wahey! The sea! Oops. Oh, spilt the tea. Thank God Eve is not here. Otherwise, I would be in the shit. She'd be well angry about that. Right, let's dive into some extra stuff that we can dive in. This just gives us a chance to dive into some stuff that we may not already have discussed. So when they were in the car at Stranraer, that's not one of the quiz questions, so that's fine. This was from Raymond. He said, on arriving at Stranraer, Mr. Ellis, he always calls Mike Mr. Ellis, Mr. Ellis, Mr. Bolton, he's all Mr. Mr. Ellis told me that there was something I should know. He went to the boot of the car and showed me a newspaper. Upon reading it, about two murdered people in the Bayswater Road, I knew immediately that I was mixed up with two murderers. He then told me that he had to kill them because Mr. O'Carroll tried to press the service bell. He said that Mr. Bolton had just put his arm around Mr. O'Carroll's throat and he died. He then said that he himself had killed Mrs. O'Carroll. He said that they were both strangled, which they were. Although, when Mike Ellis was questioned, he said the incident with the newspaper, which I'm alleged to have gone to the boat and shown him the headline and said I'd strangled the woman, is completely untrue. I know nothing about the death of these two people. Even though his palm print was found on the newspaper and obviously Janet's... they can't prove it was Janet's blood, but the blood type was correct that was found on his suit. Let's jump through that. There was a whole bit that in all the details about where they dumped the car and how they were trying to get the flights back, and it was really pathetic on there. It was like they wanted to get the 725 flight back, and but it was too expensive, and then there was a later one, and it's just, who cares? I just find it really interesting that Mike left, dumped the car at the airport. Interesting that they didn't set fire to the car. They couldn't sell it. So they didn't set fire to it. They just left all their evidence in there. They had no comprehension at all about even simple things like fingerprints. Do you know, that has been being used for more than 50, 60, 70, 80 years by that point, and they hadn't got the knowledge to be able to go, do you know what? Maybe we should wipe it down. Maybe we should just get some alcohol and wipe it down. That'll do. Or set fire to the car so it's completely burnt out. But no, they decide to leave it there with all their shit inside. And then Mike decided to treat himself by going down to Margate to the Butlins holiday camp. Well, there you go. Money well spent. Let's not go into the details of what he did that night. It's kind of interesting that Raymond turns up back in London late on the 14th. And I mentioned in the episode, so he says, on arriving in London, I caught the Airbus direct to West London Terminal. That's not one of the quiz questions, don't worry. I'm on arriving at this address in South Kensington. The reason I went there and not straight to the police was I needed to sort myself out, and I was worried about the consequences of either Mr. Bolton, who was Dave, or any of his associates finding me. And then he seems to go to a series of different clubs, and I know that he's sticking to places that he knows where he feels comfortable and he feels safe. But if you just found out that you were an associate in a robbery which had later turned into a murder, would you go and play blackjack? Would you be that focused enough that you would win 50 quid on the blackjack? No, I don't think you would. So I really don't understand what's going on there. Let's just go around. This is, I took this out of the episode while I was writing it. Ray said, at the casino, I met Kouros, the owner of the casino. I told him all about my troubles, and he agreed with me that I should go to the police and that I should write down the names of the two people involved in the murder. I did this. I wrote down the names Dave Bolton and Mike Ellis on one of his cards, and I gave it to him on the understanding that if anything happened to me, that he'd go to the police and he would disclose the names of those involved. So this card was found. It was in his possession and it was exhibit KK1. KK, the initials of Kouros. Kouros said Ray came in about 12:30 a.m. on the 16th. He wanted to speak to me. He was insistent. I took him upstairs. Kouros asked about the topic on the newspaper, the murder. Ray said, last night we arranged to go and steal something from that place. Kouros said, I asked who they were. He didn't tell me straight away. Ray said, Kouros said Ray took the Lancia to Scotland to sell. He then found out that his two friends had done this crime and he came back to London and said, I don't know what to do. So I told him to go to the police. I said, if you've done nothing, then you've got to go to the police or the two others will catch you. He said, if I go to the police, I'll get 5 to 10 years. He actually got 2 in the end. He said the other two were demanding money from a man, but he didn't have any, so they beat him up and broke his neck or something. This is what makes it really difficult with this case, is that even in all the court files and all the information that I've got, we in there, oddly, wasn't any of the three guys their criminal histories prior. So normally in an episode, I would put that in for you so you could kind of hear where they come from. So at this point, it's just hearsay, so we really don't know that much. 16th of March, early in the morning, Ray went to Paddington Police Station. He went there with his dad. He'd found out that the police were looking for him, and therefore he pretty much went straight there after the little cock-up. The car was found at the airport. I can't remember if this is a quiz question, so I'm not going to use that one. Inside the glove box, they found 2 keys and a ring. As mentioned, they found more than 30 sets of fingerprints in there. Many of them were clear. There were fingerprints on the ashtray, the driving, the steering wheel, glove box, as mentioned, on the newspaper. Newspaper, it was a whole palm print. So they pretty much hadn't cleared anything at all. It was a And as mentioned in the episode as well, they were calling their parents at home. They were calling people on the phone. They weren't using public phone boxes, which they could do. Instead, they were at the hotel and they were getting the receptionist to make the call for you. And because they're at the hotel, the receptionist has to keep a log. She keeps a log of when the call is made and who it's to and how long it's for. And therefore, she knows how to bill them. So they did it that way. Instead of utter fucking idiots, instead of just going out to a phone box down the road and putting a couple of shillings in the machine and making a call that's never going to be traced. Utter, massive effing idiots. Richard Jacobson, who was a postman delivering mail in the Gorbals area on Thursday the 14th of March, it's the same day that they would have dumped it. He looked over the railings of the church, that was the John Knox Church on Carlton Place. He saw a rucksack containing clothes, a garden hose, a garden fork wrapped in brown paper, we don't know why, wrapped in string as well, a motor seat backrest and a hammer. We have no idea what the hell is going on in there. Maybe it was stuff that was already in the boot of the car, or maybe being idiots, maybe they stole that. But why would someone with a flat and no greenery on their balcony, why would they need gardening equipment? It doesn't make any sense at all. It really doesn't. Anyway, inside the bag also was found some of Michael O'Carroll's business papers. If you look at the crime scene photos, you'll see that in the room is Michael's briefcase that he brought back with me as well. Also, a car rental agreement form in Michael's name. We don't know what the car, which car he was renting at that point. And in there was Michael Ellis's bloodstained suit, which is exhibit 57 and 58. Utterly baffling, because when you look at the map of that, I looked at Carlton Place and it's right next to the River Clyde. It literally is the road following the River Clyde. Why take a bag and dump it over a hedge so someone can find it? Why not put it in a bin? Or why not set fire to it? Or why not throw it in a river? These guys are just so incompetent. They really are. In the hotel room, so as mentioned, fingerprints inside the Lancia. They went to room 477 of the... I don't think this is a quiz question. Or was it? Oh, fuck it, anyway. Room 477 of the Central Hotel, they found fingerprints on the doorknob and then the dressing table mirror. And on room 50 of the Station Hotel, again on the doorknob, again on the dressing table, and on a drinks tumbler as well. Utter idiots. As discovery of the bodies, we don't know who called flat 35, but apparently there was lots of multiple calls. We reckon it was probably his work, Michael O'Carroll's work, because he'd called the day before and said, I'm not going to be in today because Jan's ill, meaning Janet, but he didn't turn up the next day. And his senior partner at this company, it was Carroll & Co., so therefore it's his business, and he didn't turn up. Therefore, quite rightly, his assistant and employees were kind of quite worried about it. Doctor turned up about just after 7 o'clock. Dr. Jeffrey Diamond, police surgeon, and confirmed both people were dead. It's a legal practice. It's got to be done, even though you know they're clearly dead. You've got to do it properly. Porters entered with their passkey and found a scene of horror. I can't imagine seeing anything as horrible as that. Albert Bryant, 58 years old, was the porter. He lived in flat one of Falmouth House, which is on the basement floor. And also in there was the other porter. It's in there that Joseph Buckley, they keep referring to him as the little one, because apparently he's about just a little guy. So they keep going, the little porter. What else we got? A dozen eggs outside the door, a Times newspaper, a white envelope. We don't know what kind. Must have been their post. That had been delivered that morning. And as you can expect, most people would collect it before leaving the house, or, you know, for use of breakfast. But it was still there. Scene. Let's just double check that I'm still recording. I am still recording. Great. That looks quiet. Why does that look quiet? 1, 2, 1, 2. Looks quiet. I'll oomph that up. So, Yes, both of them were found on the bed, as mentioned, hog-tied, so with their hands and feet tied behind them, ankles bound, wrists bound, and then those tied together. So basically they couldn't get off the bed, they couldn't stand up, they couldn't do anything. They're basically stuck, being effectively face down on the pillow as well. We don't know when this happened. We don't know the timings for this. Even with the autopsy report, this was made, the time of death was really difficult to establish because the neighbour said they heard stamping around and noise, but they couldn't determine a time on it. No one went to help. The room was, as mentioned, the heating was left on, so it was relatively hot, but the French windows were open. Because it had happened overnight as well, there was pathologist who was Professor Keith Simpson, he found it really difficult to determine exactly what time they died because the temperature was inconsistent. So it was estimated that they died roughly around 16 hours prior, which kind of puts it, 16 to 24 hours prior. So it puts it, it would be after 4 o'clock, which is when Ray Cohen left. We don't know. We know that the guys made it back to Tottenham because that's where they met at 10 p.m. Back at Dave's flat, and they left for Glasgow at 10 p.m. So we know it must have happened between 5 and 9. That's about as near as they can get, which kind of puts it in the window of when they would have died. Both of them were fully clothed on the bed. Both have been strangled with a scarf. It looks like they've been strangled with the same scarf. This seems to have been the last thing that happened to them. Even though they'd been stabbed in the neck, it wasn't really a stab. It looks like it's more of a torture thing that was going on. A 6-inch knife, incredibly sharp, came from the kitchen itself. So again, as mentioned in part one, they hadn't brought anything with them, nothing to bind them, no bags. They hadn't bought a knife. Literally everything they used was in the flat. Police agreed there was no signs of a break-in, no forced entry. They'd left all the empty bottles there, all the bottles of spirits, the food that they'd eaten, cigarettes that had smoked, everything. Footprints, fingerprints, the whole works. Everywhere had been there. So initially, when you look at some of the newspapers around this, police were looking at Michael and Janet's kind of back history of where they'd been out, where they'd been dining and stuff like that, because they believed that they'd entertained their guests and then the guests had turned on them. But that's only because of the way the scene looked, but it wasn't at all. It really wasn't. Room had been ransacked. Police said it is undeniably a robbery. That cough is part of the quote as well. There was property missing, although at that point they really couldn't determine exactly what was missing, because the only two people who knew what was in that room was Michael and Janet, and they were both dead. So they could only really base it on what they knew had been sold. Quite a big investigation. They knew they'd tried to sell Janet's Mini and that had gone badly. So they knew that the Lancia was missing. So a team of 100 police officers were scouring the city looking for the car. What else have we got? Fingerprints all over the room, as mentioned, on the ashtray, on the cigarette box, on photos, literally on all the documentation that was there. They really hadn't been careful with the things. Let's see. Oh, we've done that. So I'm just going through my notes. Professor Keith Simpson determined that they had died sometime in the late evening. They'd both been face down when they were found. They're both clothed and gagged. Cause of death was asphyxia due to mechanical obstruction of breathing. As it was not possible to determine the proportionate contributions made by gagging, suffocation, and in Janet's case, constriction of the neck. Both lay face down with their heads covered by pillows. So both were strangled. Janet was actually strangled a lot more than Michael was. Both were technically still alive, it is believed, but so he couldn't determine whether, because their faces were down in the pillow, and it's not too sure whether they were faces were forced into the pillow either, whether they were suffocated that way and strangled, or whether they'd suffocated on their own blood. It's their faces are incredibly bloody around that point. Janet was the last to be strangled. We know that because the white scarf was still tightly around her neck. It wasn't knotted, but it was twisted at the back. And it's believed that this was all down to the kind of the torture that was going on. One detail I didn't put in the episode, because it's hard to determine exactly what happened. So, when the autopsy took place at Westminster Mortuary, all the details as mentioned before, we kind of cleared that, but there was some human semen detected inside Janet's vagina, which obviously in that era they were unable to group. But when they examined the three attackers, they examined their suits, there were fibres from the blanket that she was lying on. It was kind of an orange tartan blanket, which are all on each of the attacker's suits. So because they couldn't identify whose semen it was, it could have been Michael O'Carroll's. So they may have had sex the night before, we don't know. Or it could have been the attacker's, so we don't know. So I didn't put that in the episode because it's really hard to determine exactly what happened at that point. But it could have been something they'd done. That could have been part of the torture. We don't know. It could have been the way to antagonise Michael to get him to reveal where, if he got a safe or something like that. Maybe that's what they were trying to do. We don't know. Or maybe they're just horrible, nasty, evil perverts. I think that's it. Pretty much found in the top drawer were some American Express traveler's checks. These were found in Michael's top drawer. These were the same ones that kind of Michael Mike Ellis had stolen and used to he'd cash them at West End hotels when he was on his little spree. Sorry, I'm just going through all of my notes, and because there's a lot of stuff that I've really packed in a lot into this episode, so I don't want to give away. I pretty much have told you pretty much Michael Cohen's statement. I'm not going to do that one. It's a long, lengthy statement, but it's kind of pretty much that's why we focus a lot on him in here, because there's a lot of details. He gave away a lot of details, and I was like, brilliant. We're going to use his perspective. So here we are. While in custody, Mrs. Bolton, who was David Bolton's wife, brought in a suit for him to wear. This was on the 26th of March, 11:30 a.m., into Marylebone Magistrates Court. She said, "Can my husband change his suit? It is clean. I got it from the cleaner Saturday. It was a white shirt, a dark blue gents two-piece suit. It was examined and it had a large blood stain on the inside left sleeve, having been taken to Zenith Cleaners on the High Street over in Tottenham." We've had this a couple of times. People seem to make the mistake of thinking, oh, I've got my suit, I'll take it to the dry cleaners, therefore it will be professionally cleaned and there'll be no stains left. But it's dry cleaning. It's like, if you want to get blood out, you use cold water. What you don't do is take it to a dry cleaners, because it won't get the stains out. And if you've got evidence on there that links you to a murder, why would you want to keep the suit? Why not just burn the fucking thing? Oh, some people are just idiots. So yeah, she turned up. She didn't want him to go into court looking messy. She wanted him to wear a nice suit, and therefore that was the perfect piece of evidence. Which the police saw it. They knew they were looking for a blue gents two-piece suit, because Ray and Mike had both said that's what he was wearing. And when they saw it, they went, right, we're going to take this down to the crime lab. And therefore, it was identified perfectly. Their committal hearing was at Marylebone Magistrates Court, where they were committed to criminal court. Ray's defense was that he was at the not a lot of information was given out about this in the press, because there were reporting restrictions, but because they needed a public appeal to kind of either prove or disprove Ray's alibi, therefore these were lifted briefly. So his defence was that he went... he said that he went to see a cup replay between Chelsea and Sheffield Wednesday at Stamford Bridge on the 12th of March. This did happen. I checked the details of the football match itself. He purchased a 10-shilling ticket for 45 shillings from a ticket tout. He was sat in the north end. He went through gate B, row 14, and the seat, he said the seat was 28 or 30 or something. The ticket was one of a pair. They appealed, and someone actually came forward who was the ticket tout, and they were able to get people to confirm that he was actually there. As mentioned in the episode, they were tried at the Old Bailey. Ray Cohen was given 2 years. That was for robbery. Dave and Michael were given 12 and 15 years respectively, with a life sentence each for the charge of murder. But given the fact that given the fact that this was 1968, they would have been released 1990s, maybe. Yeah, probably 1990s. With the charges running concurrently, maybe even 80s. You never know. So who knows where they are? I did a little search. It seems like they're still alive and knocking around. Couldn't really find much on what they've done since. So hopefully they've sorted out their lives and done something decent with their lives rather than just being a blight on society, but who knows. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Close to almost being done, Michael. I could taste that curry. Question number one. How much was the Lancia brand new? It was £1,900, which is £40,000 today. Question number two. What was the first hotel Mike and Ray checked into? Well, that was a quiz question, wasn't it? So I did balls up. It was the Station Hotel. There you go. Merry Christmas. It's a free one. Question number three. What names did they check in under? They checked in under the names of Cohen and Ellis, which is their names. Question number four. What was the name of the casino they went to in Glasgow? It was Chevalier. Question number five, why did Ian Farr, the Glasgow-based car dealer, not buy the Lancia? Because the gearbox was shite. The gearbox was not working. Question number six, which Irish port were they sailing to? Dublin. Question number seven, what type of meal did Ray and Mike have in Stranraer? It was a Chinese meal. Question number eight. What airport did Ray fly from? Prestwick. Question number nine. What film did Ray say he saw at the ABC Fulham Road Cinema? It was a film called 17. I haven't done research to find out much about it, but haven't heard of it. Question number 10. Which police station did Ray initially try to hand himself into? It was Scotland Yard. As we've seen many times before in episodes, people seem to... This has caught a lot of people out because it's the most famous kind of police. It's not really a police station, but technically it is. People often go, oh, I'll hang myself in at a Scotland Yard police station, but it's not really a police station, so you can't really hand yourself in. So, yeah, it's a bit of a mistake. It's happened a couple of times in Murder Mile. People need to learn. But it's because it's the famous one. They go, oh, I'll just turn up. Or maybe Sherlock Holmes will arrest me. Oh, da da da. Anyway, that's that. Whoa. That's me done, folks. That's me done for the... Well, it's not really me done for the year. I've got the walk with me for this to do, this episode. I've got three more weekly... What are they called? Weekly inches to do for Patreon, and then I'm done. Let's hope this laptop lasts. Otherwise, I'm screwed. Anyway... I'll be doing... There's a Christmas special coming out. So this isn't your last one for the year. And then all Murder Mile restart. I haven't picked a date yet because I'm still working out stuff, but it'll probably be end of January, start of February. But I'll do... You'll get a kind of, as usual, a little reminder saying, oh, Murder Mile comes back on this date. But I'm going to take some time off now and relax. And, oh, I need it. I'm knackered. So thank you, everyone, for supporting Murder Mile over the year. It's been very much appreciated. Thank you to everyone who's new to the podcast. Thank you to everyone who's stuck with it through the early days. Whoa. Have yourself a good one. Stay safe. And I'm going to eat some lemon jizzle. Jizzle drizzle cake. Yeah. Maybe I might go up to the shops and buy another Belgian bun. They're massive. They're as big as a head. But they're brilliant. So that's me done. Waffle over. Have a good one, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.